Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening. This is Terry Dodd. This is Walls in Our Minds, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, Mr. Red Beckman. Red, you want to say hello?
Good evening.
Good evening. Our guest is here with us, but before I introduce him, I'm going to ask you to open us with a prayer.
I will be more than happy to do that. Heavenly Father, we come to you knowing how insignificant and how little we understand of the world that we're living in. But we know that you know what's going on, and you have been so good to us because you have made so much information, so much truth available to us, and we hope that you will help us to access that truth tonight on this program. We are reminded of what you told the people in John the 8th chapter. You said, know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And that's what we're interested in, is the freedom that we were endowed with by our Creator. You, our Heavenly Father, created us, and you intended for us to be free. And we are going to do everything in our power to make that a possibility, make that happen. We pray now that you'd bless our conversation, bless our discussion. We thank you for bringing this guest to us. We thank you now for everything in Christ's name, we pray. Amen.
Thank you very much, Red. Well, I want to jump right in with Professor Brian Ants Patrick, our guest tonight. How would you prefer for us to refer to you tonight?
My students call me a variety of things. Call me Brian. That's easier.
Brian.
No, my wife refuses to call me Dr. Patrick. I'll have to let you know that. But, yeah, Brian is fine.
Well, Brian, I'll tell you, I'm excited about tonight's show. And just so you know, this is we go straight through here for 2 hours.
Right.
It's all, as your book would call it, a news hole. We don't fill this with a bunch of breaks or anything. So if you need to take a break, you let us know, and we'll cover that time and let you go do whatever you need to do to get a drink or whatever you might need to do. So just feel free to ask for that time if you need it.
I have a cup of tea before me, and I'm going to try to be a trooper about this. Let's do it.
All right. We'll start out. I mean, I've got so many questions myself. I mean, I don't care whether we get any calls tonight or not, because I'm having trouble reading your book, The Ten Commandments of Propaganda. I just want to admit that right up front. I'm having trouble reading it, and here's why I'm having trouble reading it.
Uh-huh.
Every paragraph, every sentence is so thought-provoking for me that I'll find that I've read another paragraph and I didn't read it because I really didn't absorb it, because my mind was still flying on ideas that you prompted in me from what I'm reading. So I keep having to go back and reread a paragraph because I realize that you've taken my mind someplace else completely, because it's just been so provoking for my thought patterns. You know, thinking about the practical applications of every sentence that you put in there. So it's a wonderful book. I mean, it is well written. It is, you know, it in the vein of a C.S. Lewis, it has a whole story in a sentence. You know, you have such concise thoughts, and you move right on to an example or to something else from that. And I mean, it makes the person think that's reading it, and I'm enjoying reading it very, very much. And so that's the difficulty I'm having. So,
compliment. I mean, thank you very much for that.
Well, it's sincere. It is a sincere compliment. Our listeners are not familiar with you, so I'm gonna let you have some time to kind of tell them about who you are and how you came to be a professor. And I know you've been given, at least according to your brother Paul, he says that you had gotten some special award recently, or maybe this last year, or something about that was granted. And maybe you can talk about that. But
I got a student impact award. Yes. Yeah, for affecting students in sort of a long-term fashion, which, again, I'm very proud of, because that's what I try to do, because I look upon, you know, to me, you're a professor, you have a duty to profess, and that means you come from a point of view, you have morals, values, ethics, and you try to teach people something. My goal as a professor is to bring people on board in this conversation that we call Western culture that's been going on for maybe 3,000 years, and to me, that's the big goal. So that, you know, it's a long-term thing. I mean, this is a transmitting the past and carrying on with it and carrying on to the future. So, yeah, I'm really pleased to be able to be in a position to do that. It took me a long time to get in this position. So.
Well, give us a little background on yourself and about
sure.
where you teach. And
I'm a professor. Yeah, I'm a professor, full professor in the Department of Communication at University of Toledo. We're a state-supported institution, about 20,000 students, law school, medical school, liberal arts, the whole usual repertoire. I'm originally from Detroit, and I have the scar tissue to prove it. I've always been kind of a reader and a thinker and an intellectual. I grew up in kind of a dysfunctional city. And I got interested in propaganda very early on because I became aware of the city I was in was falling around my ears, so to speak, and everybody else's ears, and yet I'd hear this fantastic rhetoric of renaissance and comebacks and things like that and accomplishments in public schools when I was looking at the products of these public schools who could not read, who could not think. And so I became very interested in the disparity between reality and language and, you know, political language, official language. And I followed that through many years. I kind of got into academia through the back door with, you met my brother Paul. He and I used to sandblast expressway bridges together at one time in my life. But I went to school. I worked my way through school. I was fortunate enough finally to find a good liberal arts program at University of Detroit, which had some excellent professors, and I was able to start having real conversations with people who cared about issues like I was interested in. And I worked here and there. I got professional jobs as a writer. I worked in public relations. I worked for state of Montana on the Montana Centennial. I worked for the state of Michigan on various events. I worked for various universities as a grant writer and development officer, various nonprofits. And I learned a lot about how organizational speak, about how governments and organizations justify themselves, often at public expense. And I accumulated knowledge. I was fortunate to run into people who helped me out. I was also ran into a lot of people who tried to stop me. My approach to academia is a little too unconventional for some academics. I'm a little bit too I teach Aristotle, for example, why they want to teach Karl Marx and stuff like that. So I had kind of an uphill battle. Yes.
Brian, I don't want to interrupt you, but your mic is popping just a little bit. You're plenty loud, but because of the popping, if you speak quickly, it's a little bit difficult to hear exactly some of your words because your mic's popping.
Oh,
so maybe
you
could just back off a little or maybe slow down a little, and that'll help, I'm sure.
I'll slow down and back off. Let's see what happens. How's this? Is this better?
Much better. Yes.
Great. So I eventually I started doing a lot of grant writing and so on for universities, and I saw a lot of programs that I was writing grants for that were not very honest, in the sense that money was going down rat holes and they weren't doing much in the way of delivery of these services that they research program there, a PhD program, and I've been doing what I wanted ever since. I mean, I've been my dissertation, which caused a lot of problems, concerned the National Rifle Association. It led to my first book called National Rifle Association and the Media, which was about how negative coverage benefits gun culture and national and NRA. The more negative coverage, the more membership. And you can imagine how this was taken in Michigan, which is kind of a liberal bastion and so on. I got a lot of resistance, but nevertheless, I prevailed and fought my way through, and I defended and earned the PhD. And again, that became my first book. I found a tenure-track job down here at the University of Toledo. And my second book was on the American Concealed Carry Movement and how it worked and how its informational strategies allowed it to succeed, especially against elite opposition. And the book that you just read or are reading is sort of a distillation of what I've learned in 20-some-odd years of doing propaganda, reading about it, observing it, and so forth. So there was a great deal of thought went into this work. This is sort of my crowning achievement to date, I believe, and I'm very proud of it. And I'm glad that someone reads it and likes it. I mean, this is good to hear from you.
Did I lose you, or did you?
No, I'm here.
Thoughts.
I've completed my thought.
where would you like to start this conversation tonight? Because, I mean, I'm all over the place because of just the little bit of this book that I've read so far. I'm a little disoriented because I've got so much to go after. I'm a little confused about how to take you or direct you. Where to start in this conversation tonight. Obviously, maybe a good place would be to give us an example of positive propaganda, because you're right. It has such a negative connotation that people don't think about the positives of propaganda unless you're a salesman or in marketing. And then people don't think of it as propaganda. They think of it as marketing, but really it is propaganda.
Very true.
And I'm just thinking that maybe one of the things that's happened in this freedom movement, in the Patriot movement particularly, is that they have failed to realize that they need their own propaganda.
You know, one of the classical propaganda scholars, a person who influenced me somewhat, a guy named Harold Maswell, he said the only remedy to propaganda is another propaganda. I mean, it's sort of like an arms race. You know, as people escalate, you get left behind if you don't participate. And you're very right. In generally in America, the term propaganda is considered a negative term. It's an insult to say to someone you're a propagandist. I know if you call a public relations person a propagandist, they turn red and they get very upset. I've done this before. But there's the guy who essentially invents the field of public relations, a guy named Ed Bernays, back around 1920-ish or so, he used the term propaganda and public relations interchangeably. I mean, he came out of the First World War, and he was essentially an American propagandist for an organization called Committee on Public Information, and that was America's first big propaganda ministry. And old Ed Bernays, he was quite a character. He made the case that propaganda actually could make a country grow. It was responsible for prosperity. It was responsible for creating new products. It was creating business and so forth. And you probably should know that, and you already do if you've been reading the book, that the term propaganda essentially comes from the Catholic Church. Early on, about 1622, one of the popes creates a college of propaganda, a council of propaganda, and the purpose of this was to propagate the church. And it was the first world communication campaign. And it was very effective, as you can see by the spread of Catholicism throughout the world. So propaganda is a fact of modern life, a fact of modern organization, a fact of modern government. And plus, you can't have we communicate with one another. But organizations communicate by propaganda. So it's a widely misunderstood term.
Indeed. You've t- talked about this, you've written about the negative argument, if you will, and I think that might be a good place to go, because I think it would be very much of interest to our listeners. Aren't false flags to some extent propaganda?
What do you mean by false flag?
Well, you talk about a deductive argument. You talk about making a premise, if you will, and then going about proving it.
Oh, I see.
Well,
yeah.
If a false flag is something that is basically a created crisis, if you will, that proves a premise that they're trying to make to steer public opinion in a direction, and there's not a crisis already in there that they could take advantage of and propagandize from that natural occurrence, they'll create that crisis, and that's what I mean as a false flag.
Oh, I see. And, yes, I can see how this works, and you're right. You know, a good example current right now is the gun control legislation being introduced nationally. Whereas people like Dianne Feinstein and her colleagues or her fellow gun controllers and so on have been riding this issue now for how long? I think Dianne Feinstein was originally elected in when she was in San Francisco on a anti-gun program. And she's made a career out of being anti-gun. It's sort of this symbolism. And they will take a false syllogism, like guns cause crime. We know guns don't cause crime because probably most of your listeners own guns and they're not criminals. It's as simple as that. But nevertheless, there's some people who live in ivory towers and in urban areas where they're not acquainted with guns. They see guns as they see guns on TV representations, and so they believe this kind of premise. And guns cause crime, therefore you must control the guns. I mean, and this is a typical kind of logical syllogism or a logical deductive argument that gets misapplied in so many cases. Plus, in many cases, we really don't know the answers to some questions. For example, how do you make the best educational system? How do you does it need more or less funding and so on? So these things are up for debate anyways. And in the public sphere, people are very susceptible to these kind of false premises, or at least questionable premises. And, of course, what the propagandist does is the propagandist interprets your reality in such a way as to benefit himself. And the arguments always go in the propagandist's direction and so on, the facts and the truths and so on, apparently.
I think it might be worth it for us to either have you call back in or for me to try to call you and see if we can get a little bit better connection, because your mic is really popping.
All right, here, I tell you what, call me on a cell. This thing works. You got my cell number? I just called you on it a minute ago. I'll call you in like 1 minute.
No, that's okay. Yeah, it's okay. I'm pulling it up. I have it. I'll call you.
Okay. Thank you.
So you can stay on until it rings.
And I will do so.
I'd like to get your reaction to Pat Shannon's book title. And the name of his book, this fairly recent book, is Everything They Ever Told Me Was a Lie. And maybe you can react to that until I get you.
Well, I tell you, I learned a lot of nonsense growing up, and I especially learned a lot of nonsense in universities, where this multiculturalism and all sorts of stuff. It comes down to it. Western culture is the dominant culture for a reason, because it works. I mean, it has it's made discoveries, it's given ethical systems that thrive and survive, and this notion of you're going to stop somehow transmitting it in educational systems and go on to something better and new is crazy. I mean, what's happening is I see students who don't learn basics, who don't know who they are, don't know where they came from. And they, because of that, you're doomed. You're not really ever going to become a citizen. limited, stunted, so to speak. And you'll see, I think people have a, if you give them a foundation and a sense of identity and a sense of direction, you're doing them a great favor. As it is now, they just become, again, consumers rather than citizens. So it's not a good thing. I'm still waiting here for a connection with you.
Yeah, I'm not sure why I didn't dial you.
Here, let me call you. I will do this. This will be quick. I will use the 347 number.
Okay, yes. 838-9176.
Okay.
Red, you're welcome to jump in anytime you want to here tonight.
I think I am going to be more silent. you two are going to have this interesting conversation, and I don't want to interrupt it. So just keep going.
Let's call the conversation, Red.
How's this? Is this a better reception?
Are you talking on your cell phone now?
I am indeed.
Much better.
Much excellent. Okay, we can continue this then. Are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Yeah, I hear you well as well. Also, okay,
very good.
Yes. This, you know, this is
well,
like,
we were talking about false flags, and you were talking about the impact of a negative argument.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that a false flag was a form of a negative argument, also, but it was also a part of this deductive argument, where they use the crisis to, and they'll create a crisis if necessary. I'm of a personal opinion that almost everything that's happened, I mean, my inclination is to immediately not believe what the propaganda is coming out of the television set or the news networks or any of the major newspapers. I believe they've been given the storyline that the powers that be, if you will, we call them alien financiers sometimes around here. That was a term that Alfred Lawson put on them, but it basically amounts to the banksters you get into without getting into it necessarily directly. You talk about this shadow government, if you will, in your book a little bit about how they control things and monopolize things. But they, I'm of an opinion that almost everything that happens, these shootings, if they're real at all. We're not getting the whole story on any of it, and they spin each one of these incidences to fit whatever it is that they're trying to do. And let me go ahead and introduce an idea at this point that seems to be coming out from some pretty good minds, and it was certainly I certainly bought into the concept. It is that they're not necessarily after our guns as much as they're after making us all criminals, because they want to play on our guilt, and they want us to hide, they want us to not be organized, they want us to not take action in an overt way, they want to be able to diminish our ability to organize by taking everything that's good and turning it into a criminal act. And by doing that, that's a big part of this propaganda campaign that is going on by these people right now. So I'm wanting to get a little bit more perception or ideas of you of how you see this. And so,
okay, yeah, I can speak to that quite well. Now my Ten Commandments of Propaganda book, and it's really 11 commandments, but I called it Ten Commandments of Propaganda because one of the commandments is that you have to reflect what people already know and believe. So people understand the Ten Commandments, so you can slip another one in there with no problem, if you know what I mean. But one of the commandments deals with this process you were just talking about. This, and I would, the way I put this is, one of the commandments of propaganda is you have to dehumanize or you have to personalize your target. And you have to do this to be able to take action against them. And I'll give you an example from, historical examples. If you want to fight the enemy is never a person. It's a caricature of a person. I mean, you remember, for example, have you ever seen any of the propaganda posters, the propaganda posters from the First World War? And they'll show the Kaiser. And the Kaiser will be shown as a gorilla, like a King Kong kind of gorilla, with one of those pointed helmets on, and he'll be shambling across King Kong, like across Belgium, with like ravished maidens thrown over his shoulders and people under his feet. And you do this because you have to kind of dehumanize the enemy. And I think that's what this kind of administrative approach to modern civilization does to anyone who gets in its way. They turn you into, for example, you and I know that NRA members are pretty mainstream, center-of-the-road good people. These are good folks. And yet, if you listen to any kind of New York Times stuff, all these kind of elite news conversations, they talk about them as extremists, or they talk about them, they say, well, they're, you know, some of them are okay, but their leadership is extreme, and all this kind of stuff, because they're trying to dehumanize them. They're trying to, or, you know, the NRA, for example. The NRA is a citizens association of more than 4 million people. And yet, when you hear about it in the New York Times, what do they call it? It's the gun lobby. And because that's because it's a machine or something, and people who aren't acquainted with this go, oh, it's a lobby, you've done it, you've dehumanized them, and this is one of the first things you need to do to people if you're going to roll over them, because you know, all of us are, most of us are empathic human beings, and we have ethics and morals, and you're not going to hurt another person. But what's wrong with hurting the gun lobby or hurting an extremist? It's almost a moral obligation it becomes, and this is what propaganda is all about. Changing the perceptions, changing titles, changing the interpretation of reality in such a way to further the propagandist cause. You also mentioned a moment ago the fact that a lot of media coverage seemed to be sort of centralized, top-down stories, sort of propaganda stories that favored certain classes and so on. And there's no doubt this is true. One of the commandments is called accommodate the informational habits, accommodate informational habits. And this applies mainly to journalists and so on. Journalists are people who generally work in a kind of a deadline-driven industry. They only have so much time. They are usually working on multiple stories. They might have political bias of their own, and often do. And what the propagandist does is you prepackage stories for them. You write press releases, you set up pseudo-events. Haven't we seen the president recently posing with children? This is what you call a pseudo-event. It's not a real event. It's an event put on for the camera. They cart the kids in, or they bring in a bunch of law enforcement officers, you know, to stand around him. And these kind of things, you're accommodating the needs of the journalists for stories and quick stories. So you give them, you do all the work for them, set them up, give them the background information. They go in there with a camera, ask a question. They get a press release and some handouts. And 30 minutes later, they're on their way back to the office with enough stuff to meet their 3 o'clock or 5 o'clock deadline for that night. So, yeah, I mean, the whole news system works like this, at least even down to the local level, but especially at the national level. And estimates vary, but between about 50 and 80% of the news that you read or hear or see comes from public relations officers and propaganda offices and things of that sort in the form of these kind of pseudo-events and this kind of accommodative informational practices. Big business. You know, in my field, in academia, if a student were to hand in somebody else's work, it's called plagiarism. In America, in the news business, this is called journalism for the most part. I mean, people Yeah, and I've seen, I've actually written press releases in the past and seen them completely reproduced in newspapers with just somebody's name on them. And I've seen Associated Press writers working off of press releases, just typing in the story. That's how it's done. And, you know, it's a big system of this, and there's a lot of reasons why this is true, and one of them is just it makes economic sense. but it saves them a lot of work, and it makes most of the news. It's this is not my line, this is somebody else, but the news is manufactured like spaghetti, says one critic of it. So back to you, sir.
Well, talking about the media, there's multiple levels of propaganda, obviously. There's internal propaganda, there's external propaganda, call it esoteric, exoteric, whatever. So there's propaganda that goes on inside the organization or inside the bureaucracy, and then there's the propaganda that the bureaucracy puts out to the public.
Yeah, the former is usually called human relations, and the latter is usually called public relations. But go ahead, please.
Okay. My point is that there's actually duress involved on the inside. Human relations, as you're saying, and there seems to be an inordinate amount of that duress today. And maybe an example of it would be a kind of a blatant, not so much inside example, but one example would be them saying to a congressman, if you don't vote for this, you know, a catastrophe is going to happen. The economy is going to crash, or you know, it's going to be your fault. And, you know,
children will die. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, okay. Now here's another thing about the news and propaganda. It's the content of this stuff is dictated by what works in the market, and you need to get people's attention. You need to get people who have a limited amount of time to pay attention to this kind of stuff. So you have to be very basic, and so conflict, sex, blood. Gore, novelty, all these things become news values. And a good portion of the voting public, I've heard Rush Limbaugh using the word low information voters recently, but a good portion of the voting public out there are low information voters. There's no doubt about this. And they glance at this stuff. They get a little bit idea. They only have so much room in their heads for one idea at one time anyways. So it has to be in these kind of sensationalistic terms. And, of course, politicians being the creatures that they are, I mean, they're very susceptible to trends in public opinion. They're afraid of being blamed for things. They're easy to stampede. And the exceptions to this are some of the old-timey guys who are in districts where, you know, they know their constituents and probably represent them pretty well. But a lot of these guys are just creatures of, you know, they kind of like little jellyfish that float on the tides of public opinion. So they're very susceptible to these kind of threats. And they respond to them. And again, look at the empty symbolism of the gun legislation that's being promoted right now. I mean, none of this stuff is going to stop any school shooter or would have stopped any school shooter that I know of. But yet this empty symbolism is, if you're a suburban New Jersey person and you hear it on NPR and you go, oh yeah, it's going to stop the shootings. That's as deep as you're going to go. And the politicians want to stand up and make that, you know, they want to get up in front of them and say, yes, we're going to stop the violence. I've been hearing a lot of nonsense like this on NPR today.
Well, I don't listen to NPR anymore because it seems like, obviously it's mostly propaganda and it's bent the other way.
A friend of mine go ahead.
Well, no, that's okay.
All right. A friend of mine used to write for a Republican news information office, and she used to call, you know, that show All Things Considered? Well, she used to call it All Things Left Considered. And that's about it. I mean, it's the world is interpreted from the perspective of somewhat leftist journalists and others and the people that they work with. They also work off of personal networks and so on, and these networks tend to be, you know, people who agree with one another. So go ahead, you had a question, sir, or a comment.
Well, you know, I appreciated the how you signed the book that you sent me, where it says, "It is our duty to weigh and consider the righteous man seeks wisdom." And,
I very much believe that, yeah.
We here at this show, we talk a lot about the spiritual battle.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, repeatedly we've reiterated the fact that Satan or Lucifer is the father of confusion, which
mm-hmm.
to me means he's a first class or first rate propagandist.
I can see this. Yeah.
But what my point was is that in seeking wisdom, I think maybe we should be looking at the propaganda that's closer to us rather than the one that's really obvious out there. I mean, the left, the propaganda of the left, I mean, to most of our listeners, the propaganda of the left is rather obvious. What's not particularly obvious is the propaganda on the right. And it's just as evil. It's just as much a part of the spiritual battle on what I would say the wrong side is. So I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about red, white, and blue fever. You mentioned in your book about that it's important for the propagandist to reflect the values and the beliefs of its audience.
Oh, very much. That's my second commandment. Yeah.
So I'll let you run on that a little bit before I prompt you more on that.
Okay. All right. And here I'm going to give you an impression, and this is not an impression based on just kind of observation for a while, but I haven't done systematic research on this, so I'm not as solid on this as I could be. But I've been watching the so-called conservative news networks and so on for a number of years, and I'm not sure that they're actually doing conservative causes any good. I actually think they've turned this into a business. They've sensationalized it. They've trivialized social issues, and they've learned how to turn them into controversial talk shows where people watch. They're several steps above like Housewives of New Jersey and so on. But nevertheless, they're still turned themselves into little empires, and they've realized that there are a bunch of people out there whose values they can reflect, and they can sort of capture this market. And so they're big on basic patriotism, and they're big on Christian values and things of that sort. But I don't really think they're doing it for the value of these things. I think they're doing it because they realize it's good business. And they've made empires this way, and I think they've distracted people from the real business you have on this planet, which is pursuing wisdom and trying to figure out who you are and developing yourself as a person and working at becoming something and becoming a good person or whatever, and I regard them as a dangerous distraction. And they're doing it for essentially mercantile reasons. And I sympathize with that. I have no problem with making money and so on, but I think people they're susceptible to this because they look for things that reflect their values. They need to see their values reflected. Does this make sense to you?
It makes perfectly good sense to me.
Excellent.
I see. Up until a few years ago, I was a victim of, and I'm not a person who likes even admitting that I was ever a victim of anything. I certainly don't like taking a victim position. Was to some extent a victim of red, white, and blue fever in that I trusted things on the right. I thought that there was good intent of things on the right. And that was the other thing in what you said. I believe you said it in the book. I've been reading so fast. But you said that it's important in order for propaganda to work, the people have to think what they're doing is good. Did you say that?
Oh, I said words. Yeah. In fact, my final commandment is use ethics and don't get caught. But it's extremely important to come at this from a point of view of this is the way to do it. I mean, this is the good thing. You look at most of our president's speeches, and they're basically a bunch of ethical posturing. I mean, we want this great vision for an America where no one will go to bed hungry and everyone will stand up and be educated and so forth. And these are nice value statements, and they sound really good. Of course, they're empty. I mean, they're totally empty. There's no programs that are going to do all this stuff. But nevertheless, and I don't think he's capable of implementing them anyways. But the idea is you have to have ethics. You have to sound like you're it's one of the fundamental precepts. Long ago, Aristotle laid down a lot of the basic laws of persuasion, like 2,400 years ago. And he talked about the concept of ethos. And ethos is ethics. It's and the idea being that persuasion is accomplished by the good man speaking well. And if someone's inherently good, if they seem to be good, or if they can ape being good, they're inherently more persuasive. It's like you're, you know, we all have some sleazy brother-in-law somewhere who, you know, always has some quick scheme and needs some money. You wouldn't give the guy $10 because, you know, you never see it again. On the other hand, a person with a high ethos, you'll help them out because they're good. And a person with high ethos will is inherently more persuasive. So that's what most of these politicians spend most of their time doing. They're very synthetic about it. I mean, for example, you'll see them posing at parades with their with children and their families and so forth. Ethos and you know, this ethical posturing is about all some of them really do, some of the higher level politicians. Look at gun control. Isn't this, you know, to make a peaceable world and stuff like this? I mean, how more ethical can you get? We want to stop the violence, they say. And, you know, it's a good scam, but it's that's what it is, though. It's kind of a shallow play, usually. There are ethical people, believe me. I've met them and I know them, and I long to be one. At least that's, you know, I think I am in some ways. But back to you, sir.
Well, I had a good ethical intent. I thought that I thought that the wars were justified. I didn't realize that they had all been fomented for evil purpose. None of them were justified. They were all by deception. They were there to make money. I thought that there was real value in our military being out there all over the world, and that we were doing good, and that we were actually, you know, helping people to have a voice. And, you know, I believed all of that stuff. And uh-huh. then when I began to realize that this whole patriotic fervor, if you will, was a part of the propaganda of the right to suck people in and to convince us that we should, you know, that like paying taxes is patriotic, for example. You know, you hear uh-huh. Michael Gallagher and so many of these politicians and even talking heads talking about that it's patriotic to pay taxes. Well, you know, that's a lie. That turns out to be a
Yeah, I always just thought it was painful. Yeah, really. I mean, you know, I'm sorry. I can't resist that. No, but, yeah, that makes sense. You're familiar, I'm sure, with you know, I mean, we've always had these, in modern times, I should say, we've always had, the patriotism has been one of the big justifications for war. I mean, in the First World War, you had situations where the British would go off and, you know, get 20,000 of their men killed in several hours, Battle of the Somme, things like that. Then they would do it again a few months later. I mean, it was just incredible. I think the British lost something like 4 million men in that war. The Germans lost 5. I'm not sure how many millions the Russians lost. But the fellow that was one of the people in charge of British propaganda was Kipling, Rudyard Kipling, you know, the poet and writer. And he was big on, like, glorious patriotic visions and so on. Some of the posters of the time would drive people to war. For example, they would show the men marching off to war, and the poster would be the British women say, go. And they would have all these, like, impressive kind of British women dressed in, like, Grecian gowns bidding their men farewell. And at the time, they were going around in the, if you were a military-age male and you were in the train station or something, there would be committees of women who would hang around and give you a white feather if you were not in a military uniform. And, of course, the white feather was a sign of cowardice. Tremendous pressures for patriotism. And yet, that First World War, we know it was just, you know, the people who used to fight in it, they used to call the front the sausage factory. I mean, that's how bad things were. The fresh meat went in, sausage came out. There was nothing patriotic about this kind of mass death and so on. I mean, it was, but yet that's how it was justified. And, you know, in that time, propaganda becomes extremely necessary because you have to give people a reason to fight. People won't fight for some sociological explanation, or they won't fight because of some business interest, but they'll fight because of patriotism. And it's the only thing that can keep people mobilized under these war conditions. Total war demands total propaganda.
Absolutely. I was fascinated by your statement that said one could say that propaganda functions as spiritual junk food. The audience consumes it because it is easier than the sort of nutritious eating that requires more planning and work.
That's true. Yeah, I stand by that statement. The one reason the propagandists get at you is is the fact that human beings are lazy. I mean, many are. Let's put it this way. Let's put it in a nice way. Human beings are very efficient at avoiding work. Is that how's that? We're a bit lazy. We conserve our energy. We have a limited amount of time. Who has the time to go off and research an issue? I mean, you in your capacity as an announcer and so on, a radio person, you are kind of in the information business. So you go off and you dig into things, and you know how much work it is just to look at one small issue. Who's got the time to become their own philosopher and their own professor and so on? So you're dependent on propagandists who are in the business of making junk food for you. And, of course, this food benefits them, the purveyors of the junk food. And they come up with these cockeyed explanations that sound sensible. Oh, yeah, that's good. We've got to control those assault weapons. But they don't have much substance, but they sound good to the person who's in a hurry who doesn't know any better. And it's junk food. Even worse is you see, I work in an academic environment, and I see, instead of critical thinking, I see people who are infected with this kind of bargain basement kind of Marxist point of view. They're not even good Marxists, because to be a good Marxist, you got to study. I mean, that's like a huge tome of, I tried reading Karl Marx's Das Kapital once, and I failed. And, I mean, I can read some pretty thick stuff. Graduate school trains you to that. But these guys, they kind of have the comic book version of Marxism, which has been made for them, pre-digested, and it controls their thinking. I mean, in the sense that they regard, they get this kind of progressive liberal point of view that, you know, history is moving towards some preordained conclusion. Marxism is really kind of a crude form of religion, the way it's applied. But these people are kind of crystallized. And they stop thinking, and they just kind of ride on the tide of this kind of ideological wave that's kind of consumed them. And I think they lose their individuality. I think they lose their judgment. And I think they kind of lose their purpose on this planet. Because, again, I'm a big believer, and we have purpose, and we need to develop ourselves and work at ourselves. And this is not something that's easy to do. You know, the Bible talks about I don't know if the Bible is, but I've always heard this straight and narrow way. That's the hard way. And people get deluded by propagandas, and they, I think they actually lose their souls over it. How's that for ultimate explanations?
Well, I agree with that. That was a profound statement, but I agree with it. Does this mean, you know, in this seeking of wisdom, we are trying to educate people. And there's a lot of people in the freedom movement, in the patriot movement, that the constitutionalists are, you know, everybody's saying, you know, you need to read the Constitution, you need to understand these concepts. We try to teach the founding principles. Are we fighting a losing battle at that? Should we really approach this thing? Because I tell people, what I find is that if I try to convince somebody of something, if they don't do their own research on it, it most of the time I don't get anywhere. Most of the time I'm casting pearls to swine, if you will. I'm wondering if we don't need a propaganda campaign instead of an education program.
You know, it's very difficult to determine the difference between propaganda and education. Usually the rule is, when I'm doing it, it's education, but if somebody else is doing it, it's propaganda. You know what I mean? It's just the label gets changed. To me, true education is a person who can become self-educating, who can actually think on their own, and who can process and analyze and seek out information and arrive at independent judgments. And I think not many people do this nowadays. Some do, though. So I believe some do. This seeking of wisdom is just not parroting. I mean, it's kind of a critical habit of mind. It's a habit of following your own interests and your own genius. You know, that's what the old term genius meant. It meant not that you were a genius, at, you know, overall, but it meant you had some particular area in which that was your genius. And you learn who you are and you learn what you like and you pursue this. And I think that's the way to happiness. I think that's the way to creativity. I think that's the way to wisdom. And you have to do this on your own. But you don't do it in a vacuum. That's why, you know, thank God there are wise people around you can talk to. But still, it's you who have to do this. You got to do the work. You got to walk up the narrow way, and you have to think, and it takes a long time. And I'm sort of an optimist about humans. On the other hand, though, I'm also enough of a realist to believe that I think relatively few people ever do this. I mean, they just don't make it out of the swamp, the morass of the informational swamp they live in. They get distracted. They get propagandized. They get, their life wastes away and it's gone, and they just haven't made these steps because it's hard, and you have to do it on your own. Again, there's help out there, but you have to push the bar up there and so forth. Does it sound optimistic to you? I don't know.
Well, I think about the statistics where that were brought out back in the early 90s. I think it was the Research Institute or whatever it was that did those statistics. They determined that, and they were basically looking at Christian men. Mm-hmm. And they found that only 1 out of 10 would make a positive change in their life if they heard a truth. And 1 out of 10 would never make a change no matter what. And the other 80% would only make a change in the context of a relationship.
Hmm.
And I was trying to apply that to good propaganda or effective propaganda. And I realized that a lot of these information systems have replaced relationship to some extent.
Oh, that's a pretty profound observation.
In that they have become normalized in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. People they've lost their social supports. They have these vicarious ersatz social relationships with characters on TV. But I think that's a very good observation on your part. Now, here's what I have to say on how propaganda applies to this. The most effective propagandists or propagandas, the ones that, you know, some propaganda changes attitudes or instills attitudes and ideas, but the stuff that actually changes behavior, it's hard to change behavior with propaganda, but it can be done. But it uses what you call horizontal propaganda. And horizontal propaganda is a propaganda that's conducted by means of groups. You put people in these group situations to talk and discuss, and group dynamics arise, and there become normative pressures come to bear in groups. And if you really want to get people to change, like you notice, like if you want to put someone to stop smoking, you put them in a group therapy or support group. This kind of stuff works. And that's how all the communist revolutions work too, like in Russia and in China. They would put people in these little political groups, and they would all, instead of having just one supervisor, you'd have 12 or 15 or however many people are in the group that all inform on each other. But the group would make people change. And this is also a principle in modern corporate management. You have self-managed teams and so on because it gets rid of middle management and people are more efficiently controlled. I'm going to extend this a little bit. One reason I think, and I'm using the example of American gun culture, it's been successful, like the concealed carry movement and all that. One reason I think that American gun culture and Christians and so on, a lot of Christians have been successful too, is because they actually have an organic, bona fide group structure in which individuals can exist. They are part of these groups, and you are with other people, you're with peers, you can have these conversations about issues, and it changes behavior. If you're part of a real group structure, and you notice all the gun people, like the local state associations and the local gun clubs and stuff like that, and they are organized. And the anti-gun people don't have this, which is one reason why they've never been able to prevail yet, because all that is a top-down vertical, so-called vertical communication propaganda campaign. But the gun people are organized horizontally. They have what I call a horizontal interpretive community where they make sense of their own reality. They interpret things. They do their own research. They find out about laws. They pressure politicians. And the way I put it in the past, gun culture has worked in America because nowadays these people meet in the catacombs, like the old Christians did, but they meet in the catacombs of virtual space. In fact, I think some of your listeners are doing this right now. We consider this like meeting in the catacombs. It's a virtual show, it's a web show, and so on. So this horizontal group dimension is very important for any kind of successful propaganda. And I think if you're going to create wise and good people, you got to have it. Ultimately, I think colleges are supposed to do this, where you create a group situation where people could exist in this kind of little environment, and you'd have peers, and you'd have discussions, and so on. But I think that's eroding. How's that for
Red's been awfully quiet for 55 minutes, and I know he's got to have something on his mind or question.
He sounds like he's got
to
have something on his mind. Yeah.
Red, you want to jump in here for
I find this a real interesting discussion between the two of you. And I'm not sure that I can contribute anything to it other than that I couldn't help but think about, in the Bible it tells us about the gifts of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the gift of discernment.
Mm-hmm.
In the Patriot movement, I prefer to call it the Freedom Movement, as I said in the prayer, Christ said, know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key to freedom, is finding the truth. And I have made the statement many times over 25 or 30 years, I guess, that I suspicion that a good percentage, perhaps as much as 50% or more, of the loudest voices that we've had in the political arena, calling themselves patriots and such, a great bunch of them are government agent provocateurs.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the government payroll, and their job is to foment ideas and such that are false, but they've got a sales pitch to go with them.
Mm-hmm.
And such, and they sidetrack a lot of people. I'll tell you, if God is concerned about us, I think he's going to make sure we've got a certain amount of discernment available to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that we can discern the fakery.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about these people that are trained especially to put lies out there that a lot of people are gullible enough to accept at face value, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody that is making themselves available to do that which is correct, that which is right, that which is for the betterment of mankind and society, anybody that makes themselves available are going to have access, I believe, to this gift of discernment. And I have been able over the years to identify some of these individuals. And when I read the account of the situation that we just had up in Alaska, our government, they are masters of this kind of thing, and they sentenced this young patriot up there to 25 or 26 years. And while the sentencing was going on in the courtroom, the FBI backed up a moving van to the provocateur's home. And the man's wife didn't even know that the government was going to move them into the government witness program to get them a new identity and all of that. And here the FBI is, they're backing a moving van up to this guy's house, and his wife and his family don't even know that they're going to move. You see, this is what we're up against in this kind of thing, and in the day in which we're living. There has never been such a sophistication, you might say, of undercover, betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
We've never seen this in all of our of the history of mankind on this planet, I don't think, because and so much a part of it is because of the communications that are available, the different technologies that have made communications so such a big thing. I often envy the founders of this country when they collected in Philadelphia in 1776, and when they formulated the Declaration of Independence, and then in 1787 they gathered again for the creation of the Constitution for the United States of America, not the Constitution of the United States of America, but they created the Constitution for the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And of course, what I was bringing out there is the technicality that has been injected into all of this. The Constitution for the United States of America is entirely different than the Constitution of the United States. There's two different things, and very few people are aware of that difference. And so it's no wonder that there is such a state of confusion out here in the political world today. I don't think we've ever had a situation in all of history where there is so much confusion. I've done a little writing here in the last few days and such here, and I may be wrong, but I brought out how that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the Communist Manifesto and the Mormon Church and the Methodist Church and the Catholic Church and the Muslims and all of that, they're basically basically all in the same game. Because they are totally dependent on how many believers that they can create, believers of their particular product, that their information product that they're selling.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just I'm not sure I have the proper definition of it right now, But I don't know if I'm injecting something in here that shouldn't be here or not, but I don't think so. And so I've kind of said my piece, and I think I better probably be quiet for another 55 minutes.
Well, that was a pretty interesting piece. Yeah. I can make a couple comments, just kind of taking off of some of the last things you said. You know, that's one of the reasons propaganda works and functions is because it speaks to the same needs that religions do. As I said before, religion comes from, the origin of propaganda is essentially religious. I mean, it was a Catholic Church institution, and it was extremely successful, the world's first communication campaign. And people need basic orientation, and they need meaning. You have to have some sense of who you are and where you stand in relationship to the world. You have to have some sense of that you're living a meaningful life, that you're going in the right direction, that the truth is possible. Because otherwise you live in like chaos, like some kind of animal or something. And I know we can't live like that. I mean, you fall apart. And these a lot of these religions have basically thriven, they've thrived on meeting these needs. I mean, everything's okay in heaven. You're going to be fine. Your purpose on life is to do the following things. And, of course, the religious, in many cases, like Martin Luther pointed out, the religious hierarchy is the one who benefits substantially from all this kind of stuff. So, propaganda is not going away. In fact, as people become less, I guess more secular might be the fashion, or it might be the current mode, as people become more secular, propaganda becomes more important, kind of propaganda of, what social meaning and stuff like this. So, religion falls off and propaganda replaces it. It's interesting. One of the big scholars of propaganda, a Frenchman named Jacques Ellul, it's Ellul, he started out as a Marxist. And he was a doctrinaire Marxist. And communism, Marxism, is very much functions like a religion. It gives you a purpose. It gives you an explanation of history, where history is going, and so on. It's kind of like, eventually we'll lead to the end times where we're all equal and perfect communism will exist and so on, sort of the kingdom of Marx on heaven or something. And Jacques Ellul starts out as a Marxist, and he eventually sees through this stuff over a period of years, and he wound up as a very conservative Christian. And he was the person who warned a lot against propaganda. He said, everything is explained thanks to propaganda, meaning that you were not getting any kind of explanation at all, really. And concentrated his life on developing, according to his Christian doctrine and so on. Wrote some very impressive stuff. And he believed that, we had a personal responsibility, that we had to develop ourselves along these lines that I've been talking. And he regarded a lot of this social progressivism and so on is just a dangerous distraction. And he was talking about, you were talking about political parties and so on too, some of this red, white, and blue kind of patriotism. And I think that would be a dangerous distraction too, to meet people's needs superficially and then and distract them, but they become lost over time because of it. So that's just a comment.
Let me just inject something again here. Back in the early 80s, up until 86, when they passed the Tax Reform Act of 86, I was speaking at quite a few investors' conferences.
Uh-huh.
And I was put in that position because I was in the the fight against the Internal Revenue terrorists and such. And but when I was speaking, and sometimes it was very large audiences, and I'll never forget one of these investors' conferences was at the big Las Vegas, the biggest one on the Strip at that time, and there were about 800 people in that big ballroom that evening, and As I spoke, I brought out how in the scripture, back in the Proverbs, there's a verse of scripture there that says, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children, his children's children. And I said, I'm going to transpose that a little bit and say that if a good man leaveth an inheritance, then I think we can say that a bad man leaveth debts to his children and his children's children. And I said, I don't think we're violating the scripture, the intent. Anyway.
It seems legitimate to me. Yeah, your your transposition seems good to me.
Yeah, well, anyway, afterwards, this dear old sister, in those conferences, most of the people were past 60 years of age because they were the ones that had the most of the money at that point in time. And they had time to go to conferences such as this. And anyway, this dear old sister came up to me, and she was a lot shorter than I am, and she's just beaming, and she looked up at me. I still see that face after all these years, because she looked up at me and she said, Mr. Beckman, you must be a believer. And I got a mean streak right up my middle of my back, I guess, because I just kind of stood back and I said, oh, no. And the poor old girl just kind of deflated. And I said, and then I gave her a big smile. I said, I'm a knower. I'm not just a believer. I'm a knower. And I gave her a hug. And, you know, I think that what we're talking about here is the difference between believing and knowing, aren't we?
I think so.
To some extent.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll go with this. A lot of beliefs out there, some of them pretty unfounded, but you're right, knowers are, I think knowers are where you want to arrive. Now, let's hope so. If you have the discernment we've been talking about.
Yes, I think so. I think that this is what our the greatest teacher that ever walked this planet. I think this is what he was thinking about when he said, know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And so I think that, well, that's just, I'm just a hayseed from Montana, and I like to make things as simple and as clear-cut in as simple a language as possible. And
I do similar things sometimes. That's why some of my fellow academics are horrified of me. I'll actually come out and make a clear statement.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I really appreciate what you're doing and what you're saying, because I think that defining propaganda, you're probably about the first individual in all of history to go into it the depth that you have, I think, of defining what propaganda is and its function. There is a proper function. When Gideon went out on that hillside with 300 men, and they're with their pitchers, with their torches and their trumpets in the middle of the night, and there was 130 or 35,000 Midianite army camped below them. You see, when they pulled them torches out and blew their trumpets, it conveyed a propaganda message to the Midianites.
Uh-huh.
They weren't an army or anything else, but boy, talk about causing a panic. And of course, our Heavenly Father had a great deal to do with that panic and everything. But You see, what they were doing was a false, as far as humans are concerned, it was a false action. It was an action made to fool them.
Uh-huh. And effective propaganda, though. Yes.
Yeah, and it's just another form of it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think we find a lot of that in the scriptures. I was trying to think of some of the different ones, and that was the only one I could think of right quick was Gideon and his escapade there. 300 put the run on 130,000 or 135,000. Well, the idea, of course, the object was that God wanted the credit for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'll shut up for. Well, I got to stay shut now for quiet for 44 minutes.
Well, just for the record, Brian, Chuck Kolb in our chat room has been posting your Amazon website for the Ten Commandments of Propaganda. So the word is getting out there, but before the show's over, we'll give you a chance to give everybody information about the best way to obtain your books and that sort of thing. But Red came out with a premise a few years ago. I'm not sure how many years ago. One of your books, I think you actually put that premise out there possibly 20 years ago. I don't know. But the premise was is that which is worse? The question is, what's worse, the tyrant that lies or the people? I think the question was, which is more dangerous? Which is more dangerous, the tyrant that spreads a lie or the people that believe the lie?
Now, see, I would choose the people that believe it. The tyrant, we expect tyrants to lie and to bully and do whatever they do. But when the people have lost discernment, when they aren't able to sort this stuff out, that's the beginning of problems. And you can see some of our problems now are basically the classic problems of demagoguery, where you have a sort of a mass democratic situation where you have a mass of people who are not particularly well informed, and the demagogue makes promises. You know the old line about bread and circuses from the concerning Roman Empire.
So consensus.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be able to stay quiet here.
Let's go ahead.
You know, the question I had in the book, and that was a 1989 model. I said, "Who's the most dangerous, the liar or the believer? The believer or the liar?" How much power does he have? But if he's got 100 million believers, people, 100 million people that believe his lies, mm-hmm. those 100 million people have a tremendous amount of power at their disposal, don't they?
Oh, indeed, yes.
And
that's electoral politics.
Yeah, that's where we've got to. That's the truth that we have to, deal with here. It's people and the power. People have power, each and every one, whether they know it or not. Mm-hmm. And this is why they all gang up in Democratic or Republican parties, because they're trying to get enough people together with their power. To make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so, here again, I'll try to be quiet.
Well, but think about this. This is exactly where we are, at least one-third, and probably more like approaching at least half of the people out there are still, even in this time when ears are healing because of the misery people are in, they still are addicted to believing the lies. And I say addicted because this is all they've known from the time they were born. I mean, I confessed my own red, white, and blue fever that I had up until 4 or 5 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I believe those lies. And yes, it was bad that I did, but it was all I ever knew from the time I was born. And that's mm-hmm. where the people are. So that's why we're doing this kind of show, is to just, you know, if it wakes up one or two or three people. I mean, we have about 1,500 people that have been listening to each one of our archives in the last year. So we're getting a pretty good effect out there. I mean, it's bigger than most churches. And but the point is that, you know, if one or two people in one of these shows wakes up and recognizes the lies, I thought it was worth taking a few minutes here, and we can brainstorm this. Anybody can jump in with ideas on it. But I thought it would be a good idea just to kind of list a few of the lies that that have been effective. I mentioned one while ago, like you know, it's patriotic to pay your taxes. That's a lie. Those taxes are they're unconstitutional, and all of the money that we pay is going to pay the interest on a fraudulent debt to the banksters. How can that be patriotic? It's going to pay for the abortions. It's paying for the propaganda that people are being lied to with. I mean, their money that they pay.
At least what I believe is an example of an effective lie. And this is maybe pretty outrageous. Some people might not agree with what I'm about to say. I've asked my students, and I've asked other people, and I find if you ask people this question, what social class do you belong to? About 95% of people will say they're middle class. Now, I believe this is completely an absurd notion, that 95% of people are not middle class, they're working class. And working class, by definition, means you're lower class. If you didn't work for a couple of weeks, you'd starve, or you'd have to live under a bridge or something. Yeah, if you're that close to the bottom, you're working class, lower class by definition. And it's certainly in the old traditional class definitions, you know, the middle classes were people who owned mercantile establishments. They traded spices. They were manufacturers. Those are the middle classes, not us poor working stiffs. If you work for a living, if you don't, put it this way, we're the class that we are servants, but the middle classes have servants, and so forth. But, okay, so this notion that maybe 95% of people have that they're middle class is what I would call a socialization propaganda. And what it does is it makes you docile. It makes you think that you've arrived, that things are all right with you, that you're kind of safe, that you don't live on the edge of a precipice or the abyss, and that you're not subject to the economic terrors and uncertainties of daily life, and that things are kind of all right. I'm not poor, but I'm not rich, I'm middle class. And I actually think what happens when people have this belief is that they become complacent, they stop working at themselves, and they stop looking around and discerning reality accurately. It comes with a bunch of, it makes people too comfortable, and they're more susceptible to believe that the world is a safe and sane place and so on, and it makes them less malleable to change. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. And again, I think it's one of the prominent, and I think it hurts people, because if you think you've already arrived, so to speak, what impetus, what motive is there to improve, to get better, to work at yourself? And I think it really hurts people. And I see a lot of students that are just totally without motivation because they think they're already okay. Yeah, we're in the middle class, stuff like that. So that's what they tell me. And your turn, sir.
The war on drugs is designed to stop drug trafficking.
Yeah, and it certainly hasn't been a consequence of the war on drugs, I'll tell you that much.
The people that are conducting the war on drugs are the ones that are bringing the drugs into the country.
It could well be, yeah. And certainly
Chip Tatum, who worked under Bill Colby and was involved in some of the high-level meetings down off of Palm Beach, with the likes of the Rockefellers and Kissingers and Poppy Bush and those guys, he actually saw both Poppy Bush and Bill Clinton standing at the coke presses down in Latin America. And he was involved in transporting coolers of drugs back into this country as a part of his CIA operations. Anybody can go look up Mena Airport in Arkansas and look at some of the stories on that where they were that was a hub for bringing drugs into the country, and it was all CIA people that were doing that. Here's another one for you. Soy is good for you.
Mm, Well, I know it's good for the farmers that live around me, but I mean, they grow a lot of soybeans, but I don't know about eating that stuff.
Asians, less than 1.5% of Asians, or actually, let me put it this way, less than 1.5% of the protein consumed by Asians is from soy. They consider it a poverty food. Grazing animals won't eat it, and it's loaded with phytoestrogen. It attacks the thyroid and brings on prostate cancer and breast cancer. It makes little boys more like little girls and makes little girls menstruate early and makes them have early pregnancies and abortions.
So,
here's another one. Dentists recommend fluoride.
I don't know what they recommend, to tell you the truth. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of these, I guess you'd call them truisms. I have lunch occasionally with a group of academics, and they're kind of professor emeriti, and old professors and so on, and some university bureaucrats. And I call them the old goats, and not completely without reverence, but, you know, they're the old goats. And they're an interesting bunch, and they're kind of liberals. No, they're not kind of liberals. They're absolute liberals. And it's fun to talk to them because all of their opinions are what I call canned opinions. They watch the news. They might read the New York Times or the local paper, and that's their lunch conversation the next day. And they do this to kind of convince themselves that they're alive and efficacious human beings or something. I'm not really sure. But this is the style. I know what's going on out there. And most of the stuff they talk is nonsense. And especially on the other, I know gun control well and stuff because I've written books on gun culture and so on. And I mean, they just talk nonsense. It's right off of ABC News. And they pick this stuff up, and yet it's almost like a currency that they spend in their social exchanges. These, like, little false beliefs, these little factoids, these little things that they think are truths. And there's nothing to them. I mean, after the next week, they're just talking about something else. They've forgotten all about them. Yeah, it's like they live their life in a state of distraction. And so there's a lot of false beliefs in this kind of stuff, or worse yet, distracting beliefs.
And they vote.
I could go on for a long time with these things. Canola oil is healthy. Flu shots save lives and are justified to be mandatory for certain jobs.
Yeah, I hear people telling me about getting sick from those things. Yeah.
Absolutely. A lot of the people that have died of late took flu shots. The ones that died of flu or whatever this virus is that's going around, it may not be a flu. But it's some of it's probably from what they're spraying on their aerosol programs in the sky, because I've never seen a flu or even a viral thing that uniformly went across all 50 states or 48 states in the country. They always have much heavier areas than and it spreads from there. But this, for some reason, hit everywhere at one time, and that just doesn't happen in a normal pandemic situation. So it had to be induced. But, we can go on for a long time on this stuff, but because there is a tremendous amount of lies that they are giving us, and they have normalized these lies to the point where it's common knowledge that these things are true when, in fact, they're not.
In the university environment, if you should have some doubt of the existence of global warming, or whatever they call it now, climate change, they're horrified of you. I mean, they're pointed at and say, look, there goes the heretic. And, you know, to me, this is it's possible. I don't know, but I'd like to see some more credible evidence and look at it for a dozen or so years or 20 years. And I haven't been convinced of this. I think, the stuff we see now is just normal climatic variance. And I'm not convinced that the planet is going to cook off. And yet, if you don't accept this, you're some kind of barbarian Attila the Hun or something. It's an interesting truism.
Can I inject another idea here? I recently had a phone conversation with a fellow in the Midwest. He retired as a public school, government school administrator. He had all the degrees and everything. that qualified him to be a public school administrator in a large city, very large city. And he retired, and then he took another little job, and he ended up, after a couple of years, having a controversy with the Internal Revenue Service terrorists. And so he had to start studying and getting himself informed, and he ended up contacting me. And we have become friends, and we have some interesting conversations. And here, a couple of months ago, we were having a conversation about the sorry state of the political world out here. He's baffled about what in the world is going on. And I said, Roger, of all the people that I know, you should really understand what has happened. And I drew a blank. And I said, Roger, I said, we don't dare forget that all of the, well, the subject came up about the do-nothing Congress. And the fact that their credibility rating was running about 10%, and Obama, his credibility rating was actually higher than the Congress's credibility.
Wow. Although I have to tell you, personally, I like it when Congress does nothing. I prefer them in that mode. But go ahead, please.
I've said that many a time. But anyway, I said, you should have figured this one out. I said, we don't dare forget that every congressman, every senator, every president that we've had, every bureaucrat from the highest levels all the way down to the janitor in the local federal building, every single one of them, almost without exception, are products of the government school education system.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one of them are trying to make our political system work the way they were taught in a government school.
You know, that's how the political scientists do it, too. I've talked to them. I mean, they said they were trained to manage society. That's how a lot of
people you see, they were taught a lie that we have a democracy. And Cicero had it figured out over 1,000 years ago. He said if when the people discover they can vote themselves benefits from the public treasury, that political system will break down. That system will self-destruct. So, you see, if they had been teaching true history in our public school system, nobody would want any part of a democracy.
Oh, and I talked to many college students, and few of them have any idea of history. To them, it's like the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement are the same thing, and they think World War One started in 1914, and they have no idea of constitutional principles. They have no idea of even what a Republican government is. The public schools are doing an awful job. All they're learning is this diversity nonsense, and that's just a slogan. That's not they have no depth. They have no history, and because of that, they have no direction.
Right.
But please, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
That could be the top most effective lie, that democracy is something that's good.
Well, you know, pure democracy is mobocracy. I mean, this is a classical political problem. Indeed.
Our founders
despised
it.
Yeah. Aristotle despised it. I mean, you had to have even the idea of having a bicameral Congress, a House and a Senate, was the idea to slow down democracy, because democracy in itself is unwieldy. Look at the yes.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. You are now in the host queue.
That was awesome.
Are we? Where are we? You're echoing.
I think it might be coming from Red's phone. Red, your phone dialed in again.
I lost you guys.
Ah, are we still here?
No, you didn't lose us. You just thought you did.
Oh, That was pretty good special effects. I enjoyed that. Yeah.
He dropped in. He had us on hold. He had one of the one on hold, and his phone dialed in again. So now he's gone altogether. Anyway, what was I talking about? I was talking about
lies and big lies. Yes.
Yeah.
Various lies that people believe. And then Red got onto the problem, some of the perils of mass democracy, which are, a real democracy. You know, Aristotle, and I'm a big Aristotle fan because he believed in ethics and virtue and such. And Aristotle thought that a democracy was possible providing you had a city-state, but it couldn't be any larger than such that all the people could sort of know each other, at least by reputation. And once you got bigger than that, it didn't work anymore. So that's, to me, it indicates that local democracies are pretty effective, and that's where they should be kept. And but this notion of mass democracy is the herding of public opinion, stampeding people and so on. The propaganda suddenly becomes a big factor in it, or big factor.
What people don't understand is that democracy is one form of taking God off the top of the pecking order. Because then, by doing that, the individual is no longer sovereign. The majority rule becomes the sovereign, and unalienable rights are no longer protected under a democracy, where in a republic, the individual right takes precedent.
And that's the direction we seem to be moving in. I mean, the notions of anything that impedes the mass democracy is, like, for example, Electoral College, which basically the idea is so that people in New York and California don't always pick the president for handicaps and stuff like that.
Well, but that's the purpose. That's the purpose of the propaganda, Brian, because it's known historically that a democracy is a transitional form of government. It's unstable. You cannot sustain a democracy. A democracy is transitional in movement toward an oligarchy.
Yeah, that's tyranny. Yeah, you've been reading Aristotle. I can tell. Yeah,
long time ago.
Yeah, no, but that's right out of him.
Red, you have a live mic, by the way. He's back.
How's that?
Did you have a comment you wanted to? Did you want to make a comment?
No,
Red, you have a
no. I'm listening now.
Well, we've got about 20 minutes. We've got about 20 minutes left, Brian. So, is there something that we have not covered that you'd like to talk about tonight?
A little bit on my intents in writing this propaganda book. I think propaganda can be a good thing, but I think what happens, is, at least in the modern age, is we've gone in this direction of sort of an administrative approach to society, this kind of top-down managerial view where, justified by mass democracy, you have these elites who run these organizations and who want to run your life and every aspect of it. That's their nature. And I think one of the big, the first commandment of propaganda is control the flow of information. And the thing about these big bureaucracies and these top-down situations, and they're hooked into mass media and so on, is that they're very good at controlling the flow of information. They excel at this. And if you if you can control the flow of information in any particular social system, you control what's thinkable. I mean, what's on people's minds, alternatives, notions of history, and so on. And I think this has gotten modern propaganda is so effective and widespread that this is the state now of the world, much of the world, certainly the United States, the Western world. And I think it's gotten to the point where it's interfering with the development of the West and so on. I mean, it's interfering with people's ability to live meaningful and useful lives. And I believe the antidote to that is form your own little groups, interpret your own meaning of life, promulgate your ideas through whatever media you can. And, you know, that was what the First Amendment was all about. It was kind of a schematic for social action. The idea was that you would be free from any state religion or any interpretive hierarchy, that you would be able to publicize your stuff, freedom of press, speech, and that you would be able to associate. rights of association and petition the government, and in a sense move the government. And I think people have to organize at local levels, and they have to do these things. They have to form, and with computer-mediated communications right now, it's a lot easier to publish a newsletter, to have a radio show, to actually reach out and talk with people and amongst people. And I think this is, it's incumbent upon us to do this. And out of these kind of conversations and so on, we get a better society, and we resist this kind of top-down administrative society that's going to turn us into some giant yeast culture of a nation or something. I you know, shudder to think of what happens if all this progressivism actually wins in the end. I mean, I don't know what kind of individuals you're going to have. I don't know what kind of character people are going to have. It's going to be like some kind of giant welfare state, whatever, police state or something. And I do not want to see something like that. I'd like to think that Western culture is going somewhere, and that we all have people will develop, continue to develop, and become good and better. One thing that I'm going to go back to Aristotle one more time here. Aristotle talks about friendship, and he talks about virtue and things of that sort. And he says, when bad people associate, they make each other worse. And they're friends of utility, they use each other, and so on. But when good people associate, they make each other better. They have friendships based on virtue, and they emulate one another, and so on. And I think that's what these citizens' associations do. I think they're good people associating, and they make each other better, and they create... They create social force in this way, and I think they can get a lot done, and I think we just need to encourage this. And people need to realize that this kind of stuff is also a way to educate yourself as well, to form in these groups and become the kind of person you want to be. I mean, it's kind of a hopeful message.
Well, there's no question that we need more print, good information in print, because not everybody's on computers. And the ones that do have computers don't necessarily do the kind of research that's necessary to get the information that they need, and it takes money to do that. One of the advantages of Blog Talk Radio is that it's not a particularly expensive medium. It certainly takes time, and some effort, but it doesn't take a lot of cash. To do it, not in comparison to trying to reach people with print and other forms of media. I guess one of the things that I wanted to be sure to ask you was, you mentioned some things that we're doing that we need to do, and it's important. I'm just wondering if there's one or two things that you've thought of or thinking of that we should be doing that we're not doing, that we can do from a practical perspective. People who are interested in taking action, people who are looking for something to do, people like myself and Red and yourself and others that are out there trying to educate people. We came forward with a civic action plan out of that Continental Congress that we had back in 2009, and I know that there's a lot of things there that have not been done that could be done, but I'm just wondering from a perspective of reaching people with a message, which to me, that's really what propaganda is all about, is reaching people with a message. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but from that perspective, what else can we do that we're not doing?
Again, keep forming groups and so on, because groups are really this horizontal means of propaganda are the most effective at changing behavior, long-term attitudes. I think that's totally important. And promulgate your own ideas, promulgate your own agendas, get those out there. And, a lot of times you can't compete with the elite media and so on, but you can bypass them. And things like, which is a very effective technique, I mean, email groups, it's possible to know just a list of email addresses is a pretty powerful thing. And coordinate people, inform them of something, and give them some kind of focused action and so on. Now, the stuff I know about primarily in this direction has been in gun politics and how, gun politics has essentially been a local battle all the way along. I mean, the concealed carry movement, for example, started out locally and then spreads to states and then, it goes across the country and so on. So this is very possible. And it's possible, it's a lot easier to lean on local political representatives and congressmen than it is to lean on people, like senators and so forth. Because the senators have a very broad base of support, often a couple of big big welfare cities in a state will make you assure that the same guy's elected forever. But you can certainly lean on people in representatives, local representatives, county commissioners, and you can start doing these things. If you want to do something good, start a pilot program and get some press on it. It's relatively easy to get press. You can get free publicity by just calling up the local news show and say, hey, look what we did. Come and see us. So there's a lot of stuff you can do to get the information out there. The main thing is to get active and do something. I mean, create your own stuff. I think that's why we're on this planet, to make something good. And I think the trick in life is finding a way to do that. So how's that for? That's kind of vague, but that's maybe the best I could do. And I think our own genius, everybody has their own thing they do well. And you find groups that do this kind of stuff and pursue it. Otherwise, if you don't come up with your own agenda, somebody's going to come up with one for you.
Well, I think that's good advice. I really do. I'd like to, you know, there's three things that have kind of floated to the top. And we haven't really talked about militias and the propaganda related to them. So maybe now is as good a time as any. We've got a couple minutes here that I can
sure.
talk about that. Obviously, that's been demonized. The propaganda has been put out there to try to demonize the concept of a well-regulated militia.
I remember when I was in grad school at Ann Arbor, U of M, and some of the foreign students, the Chinese students, they were afraid to go out into Michigan countryside because they had been warned, newspapers had been reading about the Michigan militia. I mean, that was just astonishing to me. But, yeah, total demonization. Please go ahead.
Well, it's really the only means of enforcement that we're going to be able to have, and it comes back to really some of this small groups that you're talking about. You can certainly use that as a means of organizing citizens' homeland security groups within your own area, if you will, because that would certainly be a form of well-regulated militia.
Mm-hmm.
You can communicate with sheriff's office, make sure that they are assisting you and see you as a resource for
mm-hmm.
your community.
Yeah, I would see things like offering gun safety classes, things of
right.
that sort too. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think
you can teach a lot of these concepts and help dispel some of these lies if in those type of environments.
Mm. Oh, indeed.
Go ahead.
No, I teach an American gun policy class every once in a while, an honors class. And part of that stuff is some of the readings on militias. And pro and con, I try to be very fair about this stuff and get a range of opinion. And you know, we have the so-called constitutional militias that are say, hey, we have a place in the Constitution, and we've had a place in history and the development of states and so on, and we have a social role here, and that role hasn't gone away. And I think that's a counterbalance that needs to be, some weight needs to be added onto it, let's put it that way, to avoid this kind of demonization. But then I also, Red was talking earlier about agents, provocateurs and so on, these agents who come in and subvert things. I know in Michigan some of the local militias and so on wound up getting in a great deal of trouble because I think some federal informants persuaded them or at least made a case to do some crazy stuff. And to me it sounds like just big talk. But it also sounds to me like, and believe me, even a federal judge agreed that it was, you know, there's a difference between griping about the country and doing something about it. But, you know, there are people out there there are consultants who go around who actually advise police forces on the dangers of militias and so on. So there's a lot to offset. And I think if you even found out some of these consultants and took a look at, Anti-Defamation League does some of this. What's his name down there? Who's the guy that does Anti-Defamation League? I can't remember his name. Klan Watch and all that?
Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yes, okay. Morris Dees or something, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think if you looked at some of the products they're putting out and counteract them, I mean, you know, they say, hey, you know, look, this is what they're saying. This is just simply not true. And so there's a lot of opportunity there to, you know, point and counterpoint and so on, and to represent, you know, to show people, hey, this is what we do. We're real people. We live here, and so forth. So, yeah, I think there's a lot that can be done with militias.
We've got about 10 minutes left. What would you like, gentlemen, like to talk about? We didn't finish about the militia. I am sending you Red's book. Red wrote the book, Why the Militia, by the way, and that'll go out tomorrow along with Walls in Our Minds to you, Brian. I'm sorry
I didn't have
a chance to get it out before now. But this concept of militia, there's two other things that are important, and really militia is probably the third thing on the list. The first one is putting God back at the top of the pecking order, because that provides people with the understanding that they have the right to judge the law, not just the facts of the case. That's a major point of Red's, and Red has sold that one to me big time, and I am totally sold. I believe it's number one on the list. Number two is the concepts that have been put out by Dr. Edwin Vieira. And Vieira has been big on militia, but he's been bigger on sound money. And the reason he is, getting rid of paper money, getting rid of the fractional reserve banking system, is the only way that we can break the taxing banking vortex that they are using to steal our production with. If we restore proprietary ownership of our production, really, which is what our medium of exchange, our currency, our money is the result of our production. We accumulate that as a result of our investment in labor. And they are stealing that from us. That's how they are paying for everything. That's how they buy the judiciary, they buy the school system, they bought everything, the infrastructure, you know, everything has they've done with money they've stolen from us. And they, when we make a deposit in the bank right now, we don't have proprietary ownership of it. They do. The banksters have control of that. They're the ones that are able to create money out of thin air. They're the ones that are using that to manipulate inflation, which is a form of tax. So the point is that if we put together a competing system where the state has to acquire part of its tax base by way of sound money, like a electronic gold transfer, et cetera, or you know, silver, gold, platinum, whatever. Right now, the only thing that's constitutional is gold and silver. And it's effective. And with the systems that have been put in place by people like James Turk and stuff, it's, you know, it's viable. We can do this. We can put together a competing system within a state where you start collecting some of the taxes and then offering to pay the state's contractors. That way, in that form of payment, they're going to elect them. They have an option of either taking Federal Reserve notes or the sound money and take proprietary ownership of something that's not, you know, approaching its intrinsic value of zero, which they will do. Then we can naturally grow that system competitively against the existing system. And it will overtake it. And if the economy crashes or the banks go on a holiday or whatever, then you've got the retailers that are already set up to accept sound money in payment, and they're paying part of their taxes in it. It then forces it into circulation into the economy, and your economy does not crash along with the FDIC.
Well, this is my line of expertise. I mean, I'll tell you flat out, although – I'll have one thing. I can say one thing very definitive about this. We're not going to solve this problem by printing a $1 trillion coin or whatever these people have been talking about, or, you know, in a sense, deflating the currency. And I'm kind of worried about that, too, over time. I would like to see some kind of sound economic policies concerning money, because I've been looking at, you know, I see this from a different point of view. Like, I've seen local cities around here that basically people like police officers retire, and then they say, well, we're going to stop paying you a pension. I mean, it's just astonishing. And then, of course, it's all – and then this is not to say what your loss is, you know, being eaten by inflation and so on. But some kind of sound monetary policy seems to be, you know, if you're going to be like – the progressive, if you're going to have a stable society, it seems to me you need some sound money. But the, but again, this money stuff per se is above my expertise. I'll tell you that flat out. So, but I'm interested in it. Yeah.
Well, you can. There's plenty of ways, and I'll say this for the benefit of our listeners again. They've probably heard it from me before. If you want to know about the banking system and learn about it, there's a couple of places you can go. One is that Kurt McKenzie wrote a book on money called Money. And
that's a good title.
He's got some good stuff on what is it called? Silent No More Publications, I believe, is where his lectures are on solutions. But he also gives a history. One of the best ones that I've seen is at a website. It's a strange title website. It's CSPER, and it stands for cultural. Spiritual, all sorts of stuff, but it's CSPER.org. And you go there and look up Renaissance 2 is the lecture series. Phenomenal historical and current explanation of the banking system, how it's gone awry, how they've abused it. Really gives you a great explanation of it. Then go to News with Views. It's DB Kids' site, and she has a whole bunch of writers there, but you look up Dr. Edwin Vieira, V-I-E-I-R-A, you look up his articles on sound money. There's three of them. Then you can go to the Montana Sound Money site where you can actually listen to the committee hearings on the sound money legislation that was proposed that Vieira wrote, where Vieira and Dr. Larry Parks and James Turk, the guy that patented the system for goldmoney.com. Those three people give testimony on the legislation and how it will work to the Montana legislators. It died in committee along party lines, but it's a great website where you can go to. You can read the legislation there. You can also read it at coloradosoundmoney.com site. But that legislation, you need to read it. You need to read his three articles. You need to do the research with CSPER.org and so that you can understand how the banking system works and how it's screwed up. And then you can see that Vieira has researched this to the nth degree. Vieira, by the way, is the one that produced the great work libraries called Pieces of Eight. And he also wrote the book Constitutional Homeland Security. And he's written another book recently that you can download. I think he did it in digital form because he couldn't afford it, it wouldn't pay to do it in print, so he did it in digital form so you can download it from
a digital form is a
Amazon
great way to go nowadays.
Yes, it
read
is.
Those books. Yeah.
We're digitizing Red's books, by the way, also. We got 3 minutes. What's the best way for people to get your books?
Amazon. My books are on Amazon. 10 Commandments of Propaganda just came out in the paperback version on the 1st of January, but it's been available as an ebook for about a year. And you'll also find that some of my books, I'm moving away from university publishers or academic publishers because they can't market a book, and secondly, their books are too expensive. My book on the concealed carry movement, for example, the academic publisher was charging $73 for it. I mean, my own mother wouldn't pay that much for one of my books, or I wouldn't expect her to. But I'm in the next month sometime, both of my gun books will, one of them is already up in a digital version, the NRA and the media, but my concealed carry book will be available. So just look me up on Amazon, and I'm there. And plus I have, if you look me up, just Google my name, Brian Ounce Patrick, and you'll find articles I've written and so on. I'm out there. I've got stuff in academic journals and whatnot. And I got to tell you, I might have to visit Red. I'm coming out to Montana in October for an elk hunt. I love elk hunting. It's one of my passions. So, and I haven't been to Colorado yet for elk hunting, but if there's a possibility, maybe we can meet sometime in the future. And at least I hope so.
Would love to. I assume Paul is probably listening tonight.
I think he is.
And
he's not too far
from us.
Yeah,
he's talking about trying to put together a fishing little expedition. So maybe you can come out and join us for one of those.
Oh, I would like that. I prefer elk, but fish are okay, too. Yeah. No, Yeah. So, no, I said this has been a good show. I've enjoyed it. And I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to Red. I'm grateful to your audience for listening. If anybody, I'm at the University of Toledo. You can find me online. If you have questions, just send them to me. I mean, I'm here. Just look me up. And I try to get back to people.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight. Red, any final comment? About 30 seconds.
Well, I think we need to cultivate and do anything we can to increase people's appreciation and they're putting a high value on truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something that we really need. You don't hear preachers preaching on this, and I wish we had every preacher in the country preaching on this, putting a higher value on truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm going to say tonight. And we sure appreciate you coming and being our guest.
Thank you very much.
Have you back.
Okay, good. Hey, one of the reasons why propaganda is effective, and this is not my quote, is because propaganda explains everything. That's not the same as truth. So good night to you guys, and thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Good night now.
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Thank you.
Good night, everyone. Welcome. See you next week with Walls in Our Minds.